Well, my special guest is one of Australia's most prominent, prolific and accomplished musicians and sought-after drummers. He's been very fortunate during his career to perform with many international jazz greats, as well as virtually all of Australia's leading jazz musicians. In the 1990s, he studied with Art Taylor in New York City, and in 1992 was the only non-American finalist in the prestigious Thelonious Monk Jazz Awards. He's recorded over 100 albums as a sideman, but it took him some years to release his debut album, Weaver of Dreams, and since then, he's made up for lost time with the release of another two albums. He's about to release a new trio album with the US bassist, Rodney Whittaker. Andrew Dickerson, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Hi, it's great to be back. It's been a while.
It has been a little while, yeah.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very, very welcome. Andrew, without a doubt, if not the busiest, you are certainly one of the busiest drummers on the live jazz scene here in Australia. These days, do you ever play gigs that you'd rather not play?
No, in a word. No, I've been doing it long enough and I'm lucky enough that I don't have to now. So I play with the people I'd like to play with. Yeah, there's certain leaders I love to work with. They're great musicians. But the majority of what I do are my gigs. So it's sort of it's the music I'd like to play with musicians that I'm lucky enough like to play with me as well. So I can't complain.
That's really a point that every musician, I think, wants to get to.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work because gigs don't fall out of trees and they never have. But I think if you're a drummer, if you're a sideman, it used to be always someone would call you to do the gigs and now I'm the person who calls. So it's the way it goes. Yeah, a lot of the great band leaders I was lucky enough to work with aren't even around anymore. They've either passed away or they're not working or whatever. So someone has to jump in and fill that gap and make the gigs happen. And it takes energy to do that, but it's probably less energy than sitting around moaning about how good it used to be in the past. Mm. You know what I mean? It really is true.
I know exactly what you mean.
You've got to keep moving forward and creating momentum. And when you're into it, it just sort of snowballs if you keep working at it.
From your perspective, I mean, I've been doing the gig guide and the festival guide for the website Jazz and Beyond for probably 16 years.
Yeah.
And there's been some sort of cyclical periods where the gigs will go up and the festivals will go down and vice versa. At the moment, I think we're in a situation where the gigs have gone up, but the festivals seem to have gone down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we've got Manly Jazz Festival, thank goodness, because that's really it for Sydney. It'd be great if we had another international festival like Melbourne does or even Brisbane now to supplement that. I mean, Manly's fantastic and they always have great quality music and Caroline Spade and her husband and Andrew, just so dedicated and they just work tirelessly. And it's a thankless job. It really is. And they make so much happen with minimal sort of funding and all that sort of stuff. They make incredible things happen. It'd be great if we could get something like Melbourne where there's big dollars behind it and we could do something on that scale as well and have some money there so that people like Caroline don't have to actually work themselves to death trying to make things happen.
There must be a reason why Sydney can't support that or can't seem to galvanise that type of festival.
I'm really not sure. We had one, I don't know if you remember, the one international jazz fest, I think it was the Telstra, outside the Opera House and Max Roach's band played.
Mm.
It was fantastic and everyone was like, great, we finally did it, and it lasted 1 year.
Yeah, that's right.
And then disappeared. I'm really not sure why. I mean, there's a population here. We've got the population, we've got the facilities, there's places to do it. I think it's all just, who knows, it's just money or we need people out there who can really lobby to make it happen. I mean, there's no reason if it happens in Melbourne and Brisbane, it shouldn't happen here. Mm. I think Perth has one had one.
Yep.
So you'd think in a city that sort of prides itself on doing artistic things like Sydney does, we could do it.
You're very involved with education, especially with your role as a lecturer at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. Mm. We certainly seem to be producing an abundance of talent in Australia. But what do we need to do to ensure that this talent has the opportunity to perform and earn a living from their craft?
That's a big question. It's, I think, again, like I was saying before, if there's people like me or that are willing to create opportunities for young musicians to play. That's what it's always been. I mean, that's really how you learn. I mean, the conservatorium's a fantastic institution. They've got great staff. And we're giving students all the tools we possibly can, but they're really going to get it together out on gigs, playing with people that have had more experience than you. Yeah, that's what I did when I was lucky. I got picked up when I was 13 or so years old with Andrew Spade and Bobby Gebbett and Roger Frampton and all those people. And it's great when, yeah, now we are the older generation of jazz musicians pick up those young musicians and mentor them. And there's still enough of us around to do it. But again, it takes energy, and it, you know, a lot of people are so busy teaching that they don't have time to do that. I mean, I love doing it. There's, you know, there's great young musicians out there, you know, and I grab as many of them as I can. You know, Steve Barry was one of the first people, Jacob Graham, James Sarno, the trumpet player, Jacob Parks, who's just, you know, Jacob's a great young trombone player who I sort of had in first year at the Con, and instantly you could pick him, and he's just got a trial position with the, I think it's the Danish Radio Orchestra Big Band, which is a serious gig and very, very competitive. The more of that sort of mentoring we can provide, the better. Otherwise, you're sort of stuck playing with your mates, which is great, and we all love doing that. But really, you know, you really get it together when you're with people that are more experienced. At least I did, and I can't talk for everybody.
Beautiful loping pace there to Creole Love Call. Was that your choice of that particular tempo?
Yeah, it was, actually. I mean, most of the tunes on the album, you know, Wayne and I had played together quite a bit, and like we were just talking about off-air, yeah, Wayne's got his regular Saturday night trio gig down in Canberra. And I just wanted to have a relaxed session where we went in and played music that everyone liked, yeah, and just music that feels good. You know, it's not there to change the world or educate people, and just music that feels good and tunes that we like. So it ended up, and it wasn't really a plan, but we ended up with a whole bunch of Ellington on there, a couple of Monk things and some great standards, but it wasn't one of those albums where I meticulously planned this and that and all that stuff. It just, there's tunes that everyone liked and that Wayne really felt comfortable playing. There's a young drummer I've been teaching for a few years now called George Greenhill, who's an absolute monster. He's George Greenhill. If you're out there, George, practice. he's a really, yeah, I mean, I've taught a lot of young drummers over the years, like a real lot, and George is really special. Like, he's on fire, and he sounds like a real jazz drummer already. He's about 16 years old. So he's doing that band. Lots and lots of young, talented.
Andrew, you spend some weeks in Japan performing and, of course, touching base with your drum supplier every year, probably maybe even once or twice a year. Can you describe the scene in Japan in terms of its support for jazz music?
It's incredible. It's really, there's people there love music, and there's so many clubs, you know, in Tokyo where I'm, you know, lucky enough to play with a whole bunch of people. There's lots and lots of clubs, so it's an environment where everybody can play, you know, young musicians. There's opportunities to play, and there's a real respect for the music and an awareness of the music. Like, there's a lot of people there who really like the music, and, you know, and I think the population's huge, which helps, but per capita there'd have to be a lot more people than most places, including America. People really like the music, and I think, you know, Japanese people, yeah, from my experience, my wife's Japanese and we've got family there, whatever they get into, they really get into it. If it's golf or whatever you're into, they don't do it by half measure. So if they're jazz fans, they're right into it. So people coming along and they know the music and they understand the music, but they're not listening like they're snobs, they know everything. They just really want to get involved. It's a beautiful scene. There's great clubs, and you really feel appreciated there when you're playing. They're very sort of generous with their thanks and everything.
And even the market share as far as jazz is concerned, there's always been that sort of evidence that it is a greater, much greater market share for jazz there than what it is, say,
Australia. It would have to be, yeah. Mm. It's a really beautiful environment to play. There's a lot of great musicians. Like, there's some of my favourite musicians are there. There's some incredible musicians there. And it's just an awareness of jazz. And you go to the local bread shop and they're playing Thelonious Monk. There's a, you know, down where our house is in outside of Yokohama, it's a quiet little sleepy village, and you walk past, you know, the local sort of family restaurant at night, and it's Freddie Hubbard or Milt Jackson or something blaring over the street, and you sort of, you know, you walk home with a smile on your face every night. It's part of the culture, I think, since the war. Yeah. Yeah, since the end of the Second World War, there's just been this, yeah, a lot of Americanized stuff there. And the jazz of that era just took off. It's everywhere. That sort of hard bop, post-bop sort of sound, whatever you want to call it.
Now, you recorded this album only, what, a few short months ago when Rodney was here in Australia?
6 weeks ago, I think.
6 weeks ago.
I now know how quickly you can produce a CD if you need to.
That's right. And it coincides brilliantly with the fact that he's back for Manly.
Well, that was the reason it came out so quickly, because, you know, obviously I knew Rodney was coming back. We did a couple of gigs, you know, around Sydney and some lectures and stuff while he was here in August. And it was either do the recording and get it out, or just don't bother. And I couldn't resist the opportunity. He's just such an incredible musician.
What surprises you about his bass playing?
He's just rock solid. He's very, very creative. His sound is just beautiful. He's got this enormous warm sound. And he's one of those people, he's very, very strong. Like, whatever you're expecting, it's going to be there. Really creative. His note choice is fantastic. I mean, he's everything you'd want in a bass player. He really is. Yeah, the time feels incredible. He's, you know, as soon as he picks up the bass, he just owns the whole situation. But he's not one of those people who dictate to you and dominates the band in an unmusical way. He's just got so much strength and experience. And he's a real team player. It made playing the drums absolute pleasure. Like, I didn't have to think at all. And yeah, personally, he's a very, very good person, and he's a gentleman. So we had a nice time together.
So you obviously had a clear rapport from the start.
Yeah, luckily. I mean, we'd played together about 20 years ago, but yeah, I can vaguely remember it, and he could vaguely remember it as well. And yeah, luckily everything worked out, and it felt great between us. Yeah, the first few bars of the first gig, yeah, he really kicked me in the bum. It's like, okay, here we go. And I'm thinking, all right, yeah, I've got to not lift my game, but it wasn't like playing with the bass players I normally play with. He's got something very special and different happening.
Now, what about Wayne Kelly? Because this is the second album you've recorded with Wayne. What special qualities does he bring to the bandstand?
Oh, Wayne, I mean, Wayne's sort of unknown quantity for a lot of people. He, like you said, he lives in Canberra. He rarely ventures outside Canberra. You know, and for me, if I had a sort of wish that could be granted, I'd wish that Wayne was as important to other people as he is to me. He's got a little group of close friends and fans and followers that really love him, but he's not really that well known. And I guess being in Canberra, and he moves in his own little circle. He's just, yeah, to me, he's one of those beautiful players who combines the whole tradition of jazz piano with a real sense of adventure and spirit. He's not stuck in any sort of genre. He's not a modernist or old-fashioned. He just plays good jazz, and his playing's informed by all of the great piano players. He reminds me of, you know, someone like, you know, Mulgrew Miller or Kenny Kirkland, who's absorbed the whole tradition, but it's still modern and it's still current and it's a little edgy at times. And he's got a beautiful lyricism. And yeah, like all good musicians, the way he plays reflects his personality. Like, Wayne's, yeah, sort of beautiful, spirited person, you know, really generous nature and very kind and funny and quirky. And he sounds like that as well. I just, you know, what I'd like is for him to be much more well-known and appreciated. So hopefully these CDs are sort of doing that.
There was a question on social media this morning about the idea of music industry, quote-unquote, whereby the phrase infers organisation, it infers money, management, administration, all the things that are sort of the antithesis of music as an art form itself. Mm. So how do you reconcile that? It was an interesting discussion.
Good question. I mean, it's all just names and labels, isn't it, and words. So, I mean, if you want to survive doing what musicians do, you have to treat it to some extent like a business. I mean, it is. It's my business. It's what I do. And that doesn't affect the music I play or the artistic sort of integrity of it or anything like that. But if I don't treat it like a business, I'm not going to be successful. And yeah, unfortunately these days that does mean you have to engage in promotion. You have to be on social media. You have to get out there and push it. You know, you have to send out emails and that sort of stuff. And if people don't like it, yeah, they can always unsubscribe and they don't have to read it. Yeah, some people get really bugged about it. Some musicians get really peeved about it. You know, they see this sort of what on the surface looks like sort of self-promotion. And they sort of get a bee under their bonnet. But there's no other way of doing it. Like, if you don't do it, A, you don't get an audience. And B, people want to, you know, if I don't send out regular emails, people say, hey, I didn't get the email, what's going on? And if you don't do it on Facebook, people say, oh, I didn't know the gig was on, why didn't you put it on Facebook? And it's a sort of necessary evil. You know, it takes a lot of energy, but, you know, it's, I mean, I don't know what it used to be before that, you know, like a poster on a telegraph pole or something. Always been promoted. You've got to let people know that you exist and what you're doing. And, you know, you've got to try hard not to overstep the limit. Like, you don't sort of email people 10 times a week. But, yeah, once a week or once a fortnight, people don't really seem to get bugged by it. And if they do, they can delete it or unsubscribe and all that sort of stuff. So you need to treat it as a business. If you're going to be successful and keep things going, it's social media and all of that sort of stuff. And that's the only way to keep momentum going.
Andrew Dickerson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.